This week in KMA Land, earthquake rocks parts of KMA Land. Shipley declines re-election bid. Beyer announces state Senate candidacy. Costello supports HMO tax increase. Vision Shenandoah celebrates recent property sales. And Page County supervisors approve courthouse clock tower repair bid. I'm Mike Peterson. Well, you know, KMA Land experiences all kinds of weather-related phenomena. Heat, cold, rain, snow, tornadoes, thunderstorms, floods. But earthquakes? Well, parts of KMA Land felt a 4.1 magnitude earthquake that struck near the Nebraska-Kansas border last Sunday afternoon. According to the U.S. Geological Survey's website, the earthquake occurred roughly 3 miles east of Coles, with first reports coming in just before 1 p.m. Two smaller earthquakes, both reading as a 2.6 on the Richter scale, occurred in the same general area later in the afternoon and evening. Jessica Thompson Jody is a research geologist with the U.S. Geological Hazard Center in Colorado. Thompson Jody tells KMA News while seismic activity in southeast Nebraska is rare, minor to moderate earthquakes like the ones recorded on Sunday are not unheard of.
They happened in an area where we don't have any mapped active faults, which is why it's an area of low seismic hazard. But there are deeper inherited fault systems in that region. And the style of faulting that happened there looks like it's called a strike slip fault. So it was a left lateral fault, and it's sort of the same orientation and type of movement that we would expect on some of these deeper faults in that area.
While not pinpointing a specific fault that caused Sunday's earthquakes, Thompson Jody says a zone of fault called the Central Plains Megashear exists deep within the Earth's crust, stretching from southeast Missouri to northwest Montana. Though it's typically inactive, Thompson Jody says that same lack of major faults and breakup is also likely the reason why rumbles and seismic waves were felt so far throughout the region.
In kind of the central and eastern U.S., we have much older rocks. They're a lot harder, and there are less inherited faults through them. They're broken up less by faults. So that ground shaking and those seismic waves that are generated by the earthquakes can travel a lot farther. And so the same size earthquake that would happen in California versus one that would happen in the central or eastern U.S., it's felt over a much bigger area in the central and eastern U.S.
According to the USGS Did You Feel It map, reports from residents stretch from Arnold in central Nebraska over to Council Bluffs and Glenwood and down to Kansas City. Thompson Jody says the current pager estimate for the 4.1 magnitude earthquake indicates potentially minor economic losses, which she adds is typical of minor to moderate earthquakes.
From kind of the self-reported Did You Feel It, where citizens can go to our website and submit how they, you know, the kind of shaking that they felt. It looks like in that region there was moderate shaking, light to moderate shaking, which is typically associated with none or very light damage.
While there is a zone of faults deep within the Earth's crust in the region, Thompson Jody indicates the earthquakes felt nearly 200 miles away in southeast Nebraska are relatively rare.
This is an area of low seismic hazard, and we typically only see these types of small to moderate earthquakes, you know, perhaps every couple years to tens of years would be my guess.
You can find out more information about the incident or report an experience potentially related to the earthquake on the U.S. Geological Survey's event page for the earthquake. KMA Land was rocked by a political earthquake this week. State Senator Tom Shipley announced Wednesday he will not seek re-election in the Iowa Senate's 9th District in this year's elections. First elected in 2014, Shipley was re-elected in 2018 and 22. Born and raised in Adams County, Shipley graduated from Villisca High School in 1971 and from Iowa Western Community College in 73. Shipley earned a Bachelor's of Science in Agriculture Education in 1975 from Iowa State. A fifth-generation farmer, the Nottoway Republican worked at Land O'Lakes United Farmers Mercantile Co-op and the Iowa Cattlemen's Association. He also taught vocational agriculture at Fremont Mills School in Tabor after graduating college. In a 2018 Meet the Candidates interview with KMA News, Shipley says he wanted to provide a rural voice at the State House.
It became more obvious in the last 4 years that rural Iowa certainly needs a voice in the state capitol. We're getting outnumbered, and frankly, there's just a lot of people who don't understand what we do, and I have become about as strong of an advocate for rural Iowa as there is, because I believe our people are just as important as those in Polk County.
Though it's his last legislative session, Shipley and other lawmakers still have work to do before wrapping up the session for another year. Well, speaking on KMA's Morning Line program Wednesday morning before he announced his retirement, Shipley says the 2026 session has a fast feel to it.
It's not just me, but a lot of people around this building seem to think that the session is moving along very quickly. But there's still lots of things left to address that were talked about a lot before we got here. So it may slow down, but I don't know. It's moving along awfully quickly, seems like.
One of the State House's biggest pending issues this year is property tax reform. Dueling proposals from the Iowa House and Senate and Governor Kim Reynolds are still under review. But Shipley says local officials are finding favor with the Senate version. Among other things, the Senate bill provides for a soft 2% cap for most levy rate increases, rather than the hard 2% limit on local government's property tax revenue growth each year included in the governor's proposal.
In my discussions with counties and cities, the Senate version of the property tax bill seems to be the most favorable one, that they seem to think it's pretty workable. So we shall see. Other than that, I just get bits and pieces. I'm thinking our Senate bill is going to be very good for agriculture.
Another question mark involves legislation involving eminent domain or carbon capture pipeline projects. The Nottoway Republican expresses confidence that some action will take place this year. He cites a Senate proposal expanding the pipeline corridor, allowing companies to seek voluntary land use agreements within 5 miles of either side of a proposed pipeline or anywhere in a county where the pipeline company held an informational meeting.
This is more acceptable to them than the hard situation. Just you're going to use it, and the route is fixed. And it does give people options to participate if they want to. So I think we will. But then again, that and a dollar will get you a cup of coffee downtown. So
back in January, the Iowa House approved a measure banning the use of eminent domain for carbon capture and sequestration projects. Already, one potential successor to Shipley is launching his candidacy. Cass County Supervisor and Farmer Steve Beyer announced his bid for the Iowa Senate's 9th District seat on Wednesday. A Cass County native, Beyer was born and raised in Noble Township before graduating from Griswold High School and attending Westmar College and Duke University, graduating in 1978. Beyer then taught chemistry and physics for over 25 years, including time in North Carolina before returning to the area in 1981 and teaching in the Griswold and Atlantic school districts. In addition to currently working on his family's multi-generational farm, Beyer and wife Barb formed Noble Township Educational Services, providing instructional curriculum services to smaller school districts. Beyer tells KMA News his interest in running for the Republican ticket in the June primary for the Iowa Senate's 9th District stemmed from his service in local government between 11 years in the Griswold School Board and 10 years as a Cass County Supervisor.
You're kind of sandwiched in there. You're trying to provide services for your community and at the same time balance that with the regulations and directives that come out of the state legislature. So I've always had that dynamic balance that I've been working with. And when Tom Shipley decided that he was going to retire from the Senate, I thought, well, that's an opportunity for me to continue what Tom has done.
Beyer says he hopes his experience with local entities could help strike a balance in property tax reform. But the Iowa legislature is currently considering a trio of bills that would alter the state's property tax system, including that 2% cap on property tax revenue growth for cities and counties we talked about earlier.
People are still going to expect their potholes fixed and want gravel on their road, and they don't want to drive 75 miles to be able to get the services that they can get in their local county courthouse. So that's probably the biggest challenge right now, is finding, really threading the needle on how much tax relief there can be and still provide the necessary services.
Another issue gripping the state capitol for several years is eminent domain and its relation to carbon capture and sequestration projects that use pipelines. Well, Beyer says eminent domain is another issue that lawmakers need to strike a balance on.
One of the things that we first accomplished when I came on the Board of Supervisors was getting an ethanol plant here in Cass County, and it's had a very beneficial impact on the price of corn here in the local area. It gives us another end user. So, you know, I understand the desire to help the ethanol industry, but it's not a public entity. And I really think if Summit had a chance to back up and do it all over again, they would have used a different approach.
In a press release Wednesday, Shipley indicated his support for Beyer's campaign. Beyer also commended Shipley for his service to the State House and for being a strong advocate for agriculture and rural Iowa. At least one KMA land lawmaker supports a bill imposing a temporary tax increase against HMOs to cover deficits in Iowa's Medicaid program. Earlier this week, an Iowa Senate subcommittee held a public hearing on a measure calling for a one-year tax increase on health management organizations from 1% to 3.5%. State Senator Mark Costello is among the bill's supporters. Speaking on KMA's Morning Line program Thursday morning, Costello says the increase would allow the state to extend its Medicaid coverage while avoiding using its general fund to cover the Medicaid deficit.
We tax them, and then we were able to invest that back into the Medicaid program and receive a matching drawdown from the federal government, and then we're able to invest that back into our Medicaid program and increase that without really having an impact on the managed care organizations.
The Imogene Republican says the bill would also help secure federal funding for Medicaid services in the state.
The federal government has lowered their match for us. It'd be around $200 million less that we'll get because the pandemic rules have expired, and so we're going to try and cover that with this.
The proposed tax increase would raise over $60 million in taxes from Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield's HMO, up from an estimated $11.5 million. Both HMOs and insurance companies oppose the measure, which they claim amounts to a 238% tax hike, one that would be passed on to consumers. Costello says lawmakers are looking at ways to cushion the blows for insurance companies.
The insurance companies hate it, and I knew they would, but one thing about it is temporary. It's just for this year. There's a window that the federal government has approved for us to do this. And so we're just raising it 2.5% over what they are doing now, which is around 1%. So that will just be for this year, and then it will go back to just under 1%. So, you know, we're going to try and work out other ways we can help them to offset that, but they can't raise their rates in the middle of the year. So it could be a difficulty for some of them.
If approved by the legislature, the tax hike would be effective retroactively. Some vacant properties in Shenandoah now have new owners. Back in October, Vision Shenandoah hosted a tour of opportunity featuring 14 properties available for business development. Of those properties, sales were recently completed at a commercial building at 404 South Fremont Street, the Sanctuary at 207 South Elm Street, and the former Valley News Today offices at 617 and 619 West Sheridan Avenue. Properties were rented at 111 Sycamore Street and 706 West Sheridan Avenue. Vision Shenandoah Executive Director Margaret Brady told KMA News the tour turned out to be a great idea.
After only 100 days, we had over $1 million when commercial property changed hands. And what a great idea. We got the idea from Iowa Economic Development. Grundy Center had done this, and we saw it at one of their conventions. And John Hoyt from the Lakin Board suggested that, you know, you need to be marketing these great commercial properties you have here.
Brady hopes other potential buyers who expressed interest in other available properties.
There were several that connected with potential new businesses, but I don't think they've quite worked through the details yet. We're hopeful that that's going to work out in the next few months.
Another new development involves the potential renovation of the former George J. Drug Building at 612 West Sheridan Avenue. In late January, the Shenandoah City Council approved Lucius Sheridan's proposal for the city's application to the Iowa Economic Development Authority's Community Catalyst Grant Program. Brady says she's excited about Sheridan's proposal.
They have made it through the first round of Community Catalyst, so we're going to help them help the city put together a great application for them to hopefully get that $100,000 to help rehab that building. We're excited because they are going to be bringing the soda fountain back and trying to restore that building back to its original glory. And so we couldn't ask for a new young entrepreneur has come to town. They've taken on a big project and they're going to bring it back into a historical flavor. I think that's just win on every level.
The IDEA's proposal provides up to $100,000 in grant money to projects aimed at renovation or demolition of underutilized buildings. The council's approval also included the required match from the city for the project of up to $50,000, which includes a $40,000 loan from the city's revolving loan fund and in-kind contributions. Awardees will be announced in June. Brady, by the way, made her comments in a recent edition of KMA's Morning Line program. Following a long-awaited insurance review, repairs are set for the Page County Courthouse's roof and clock tower. Meeting in regular session late Tuesday afternoon, the Page County Board of Supervisors unanimously accepted the bid from Martino Commercial Roofing out of Omaha for just over $1.5 million. After the roof and clock tower sustained heavy damage two summers ago, plans called for replacing the existing copper roof with a painted Galvalume steel standing seam product and recladding the entire clock tower. Supervisors Chair Judy Clark says the county's insurance is planning to cover nearly the entire project, with some funds held back until construction is completed.
The depreciation of $103,284, which will come to us when the project is done. So right now, they, as soon as they get this signed sheet, they should be issuing a check to us in the amount of $1,427,351.
Approval of the bid has been on hold since early last month, pending insurance review of the proposal. Clark says the contractor proposed starting work on the roof this spring, but she says that with nearly a months-long delay in approving the bid, the timeline for the clock tower could be pushed back.
The problem is going to be with the clock tower because it went on so long and they didn't give us an answer. It's probably the clock tower probably will not be back on Christmas. So we'll see.
Clark says the county must provide a $1,000 deductible for insurance to cover the project. Well, Montgomery County is making a major change in how the county's department head salaries are decided. By a 3-2 vote Tuesday morning, the county's Board of Supervisors approved a resolution dissolving the board, which recommends salaries for the county's elected officials. Action taken by the Iowa legislature in 2024 allows county boards of supervisors to eliminate comp boards and carry out its duties. Supervisors Mark Peterson and Alex Burton voted against the resolution, while saying he would have favored the dissolution 3 to 4 years ago. Peterson says he now opposes it because of an amendment allowing the supervisors to adjust percentage salary increases.
I think it's been good, well, could be good, to have the compensation board so that there's other people involved in the county with coming up with reasons to change salaries of the various offices. So I guess with the way that it's set up now, I'm not in favor of dissolving it. I really don't want the responsibility of having to do the work that they had been doing.
Supervisors Chair Charlotte Schmidt voted in favor of the dissolution. Even with comp board recommendations, Schmidt says the supervisors make the ultimate decision.
My observation when I first came on this board is the compensation board had a lot of seasoned people on it. They had been on it for a while. And then it changed and we got new people on it. And I know that Auditor Jill had sent out a packet to all the new members that explained exactly what your responsibility. Then I went to that compensation board meeting and it's like nobody knew what to do. That they were, you're representing somebody, but they didn't know what they'd do.
Supervisor Bryant Amos also voted in favor, questioning the comp board's necessity.
There's nothing that the department heads can't present us with that was presented at the compensation board. It comes from the department heads anyway. They just have somebody else present it. We make the final decision. To me, it's just become a wasted step. And again, now it, back before, you had to treat everybody with that recommendation equally. Well, that's not there anymore. We decide.
Supervisor Mike Olson sided with the majority, saying the comp board's recommendations are often out of line, forcing the supervisors to cut the proposed salaries. Near the meeting's end, Peterson announced he would not seek re-election this year, saying 12 years on the board is enough. Red Oak City Council members this week split on efforts to revise the city's building codes and permits. By a 3-2 vote at its regular meeting Monday evening, the Red Oak City Council approved the first reading of an ordinance amendment regarding building codes and building permits. Primarily, the updated ordinance would combine building codes and permits into a single chapter, update references from the 2015 to the 2025 International Building Codes, identify the climactic zones of Red Oak, and establish that building permit fees are set by the council by resolution. City Administrator Lisa Cotter says the ordinance, which was formulated through extensive discussions with CIPCO Executive Director John McCruddy, also outlines the types of building projects that require a city building permit, including those involving structural integrity.
Where you're messing around with load-bearing walls, beams, columns, girders, trusses, foundations, structural walls, or roof systems. So if you're doing carpet, if you're painting, if you're just putting in a single cupboard in your kitchen, none of that needs a permit. Weather resistant or weather tightness is exterior walls, roofs, exterior doors, windows, skylights, building envelope components that protect against water intrusion or air filtration. Any sort of fire rated things. So if you're putting on a garage that wasn't previously attached, we obviously want to make sure that you have it put in there properly so that people are safe in their homes.
The proposed ordinance amendment will also double the building permit fee if the contractor or individual did not file a permit prior to starting construction, with a double amount of at least $200. McCurdy also indicates they moved toward a flat fee for smaller projects because fewer inspections were needed than for larger commercial projects. He adds the updated ordinance also removes an arbitrary number that required inspections only for repairs or construction costing $10,000 or more.
Because really, there were some things that I think as a city and some residents were looking at thinking, gosh, I think that needs looked at because it's a safety hazard. And the building permit said, well, it's worth $9,999. And so we didn't necessarily have as good of grounds to go and look at it.
Council members Levi Franks and Terry Cuppy cast the dissenting votes, with both raising concerns about whether some items needed to be inspected through SWPCO if installed by licensed contractors. While it's been in place since 2015, Franks was hesitant about permits and inspections for work within existing structures done by reputable and licensed contractors.
I thought it was just for structure adding on to a house that they would have to have a permit, and not the structure itself, the house. I still don't see why you have to do it. I mean, for window siding, I mean, it's, I don't know, was that the, this didn't seem right to me.
Council members Sharon Bradley, Janice Lester, and Adam Heatbrink voted in favor, while acknowledging that updating the process and possible penalties could be uncomfortable. Bradley says it's necessary to ensure major property updates are done correctly.
We have to realize that things like this have been overlooked, and we're trying to remedy all those things that we've had in the past that we really need to take care of. And if we don't, we're going to continue. So, and people are just getting by with it. That's all I'm saying.
The ordinance requires a second and third reading before being adopted by the council. Mills County's remaining opioid settlement dollars are being used to assist with certain equipment purchases for the Glenwood Fire Department. At its regular meeting Tuesday morning, the Mills County Board of Supervisors unanimously approved allocating more than $2,300 from the county's opioid settlement fund for purchases of nitrate gloves, medical supplies, and monitoring systems that fire department personnel use when responding to calls involving an opioid overdose. Glenwood Fire Chief Matt Gray outlined the specific equipment that funds would cover.
We are going to use for protection and treating opioid overdoses, and also entitled O2, basically capnography sensors. We put these off the majority of our patients, basically because when we get called to a call, we don't know whether that person's in an overdose. They get called to be unresponsive or lethargic or whatever. So we have to treat every patient the same.
The money comes from an agreement that the Iowa Attorney General's Office signed on to in 2022, providing money from manufacturers to help abate the opioid crisis through prevention and treatment. Gray says the Entitle O2 sensors are hooked up to the cardiac monitors.
It's a tool that we use to plug into our cardiac monitors. Also, it adheres to the oxygen, and we're providing sufficient oxygen to basically resuscitate them. And also, it measures capnography. So we're seeing how well the ventilation and how well the airflow is moving through the body, which gives us our medics so that they administer any type of medications and perfusing through the body.
The board's action was also pending a review of which part of the opioid settlement fund guidelines the purchase would fall under. That wraps up this week in KMA Land. Be listening each week at this time for This Week in KMA Land. And for more information all the time, log on to KMALand.com, where you can also hear this program in its entirety. For the entire KMA News team, this is Mike Peterson. Thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend. This Week in KMA Land is a presentation of KMA News.